up, girl. Be girl. Lucy, G, 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 good dogs, good dogs.
Welcome to the I Did a Pod, a podcast about what else? Cruising with your sled dogs. Oh, and the Iditarod. We are a production of Alaska Public Media. Off the top, that was Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Brent Sass in a clip courtesy of Iditarod Insider. I'm your host, Casey Grove, joined once again by my colleague, reporter Tegan Hanlon. Hi, Tegan.
Hello, Casey.
All right, well, before we pull the hook and mush on out of here, how about a word from our sponsor?
Hi, this is Lee Bowling from the band Sassafras. We created the song you're listening to right now for the Iditapod. We love the Iditapod.
Thanks, Lee. We love you too, I guess. I don't know. This is awkward. Anyway, a preview of what is to come in today's episode, episode 3, season 5. Gunnar Johnson, a musher in this year's Iditarod, since we left off, has tested positive for COVID, is not in the race anymore. We're going to talk about that. We also have our friend Zachariah Hughes, who is working for the Anchorage Daily News and is out on the trail, here to talk about COVID concerns or not, and how the mushers are feeling about returning over the trail that they've already been down and some of the troubling spots that they've already seen and how that's entered their psyche. Also, since we left off, the trail has been shortened just a little bit. We'll get into that. We also have three-time Iditarod champion Mitch Seavey on the phone to talk about race strategy and how mushers ended up where they're at and what they might do going forward. So let's dive right into this. Tegan, we've talked about the COVID mitigation plans and all the testing either before the race, during the race. Apparently, there will be some testing afterward. But somebody tested positive. What happened?
So Gunnar Johnson, a musher from Minnesota who's running dogs from a local musher, Jim Lanier's kennel, tested positive on the way into McGrath this week. The McGrath is the checkpoint more than a third of the way into the Iditarod on the way out. So this positive test comes after three other COVID tests that the mushers had to take. They had to take one 2 weeks before the race start, on the Thursday before the race start, and then at the race start on Sunday, moments before they left with their dogs. So for Johnson, the race says all those tests were negative. Then he gets out on the trail. He mushes about 300 miles, stopping along the way at checkpoints, including his 24-hour break in Nikolai. And then at the next checkpoint, McGrath, he tests positive for COVID-19.
So this wasn't just like one positive test that maybe could have been a false positive. It was a little bit more intense than that, right?
Right. So upon arrival in McGrath, mushers take a rapid test, and the race has said in the past that those results would come back in roughly, I think, 20 minutes. So he tests positive on that first test, and then he has to take a molecular-based test. The results take a little bit longer. He tests positive again, and then according to the race, they gave him a third test, and he tested positive for a third time.
That sounds pretty thorough, and it seems like they made sure before, you know, having him pull out of the race that he really, in fact, was COVID positive. How is he doing, though? I mean, it didn't sound like he had any symptoms, though, right?
Right. That's what race officials said, that he was asymptomatic. In line with their COVID-19 protocols, he was pulled out of the race upon those positive tests and isolated in an Arctic oven tent at McGrath. And then they started this contact tracing process. And contact tracing feels like one of those words that has entered all of our lexicons over the past, you know, year. But contact tracing on the Iditarod Trail is obviously a really unique process, according to Dr. Jody Guest, who's an epidemiologist working with the race.
The race marshal and I have been going through all of the time in and out for all the mushers. What we're really trying to do is pinpoint who was at Nikolai during Gunnar's 24-hour time that he had there.
And so Dr. Guest and the race director are looking not only at who was in Nikolai during Gunnar's 24-hour stop, but specifically who shared a tent with him there. And we have yet to hear from the Iditarod who those two mushers are who shared a tent with Johnson. Guest, the epidemiologist, says it's harder to track them down than you might think.
People crawl in and out during the night, and you're not having a lot of conversation. They are also masked, and we know it was during the middle of the night. It's super cold. People have a lot of stuff on. And so he's just not sure who those two people are.
So as the Iditarod continues to try to identify who those mushers are who shared a tent with Johnson and were possibly exposed to the coronavirus, they've also made some changes to testing. Well, one change specifically, there was the mandatory COVID test on the way into McGrath. And since mushers then go to Iditarod and turn around and come back, Jody Guest says all teams will now also have to be tested again on their return trip through McGrath.
Interesting. So we are seeing some impact on the race from COVID-19 in terms of a musher actually testing positive and having to leave the race, but it's unclear at this point really how far that might ripple. Has the Iditarod said anything about where they think Gunnar got infected? And I guess, do they anticipate any other positive tests?
So in terms of where Gunnar might have got infected, the Iditarod says that they actually have a pretty good idea. They say that he was in a truck with a dog handler before the race started, and that dog handler later tested positive for COVID-19. As for any other positive tests on the trail, as of this recording, we haven't heard of any outside of Gunnar Johnson's.
Gotcha. So it sounds like we don't quite know yet if there's maybe a wider outbreak. I'm sure that the Iditarod is hoping that there is not. We have no indication at this point that that's the case. But we are still curious about what the mushers think about this and maybe any other impacts on the race. And since we're not out on the trail, but our friend Zachariah Hughes is, we're now going to bring in Zach Hughes, Iditapod co-founder, out on the trail this year for the Anchorage Daily News. Hi, Zach.
Hello, Casey and Tegan, and I apologize for any delays on my end with the connection. It's like 33 below here today, and I think that's maybe why the internet is being more obstreperous than normal, but I can't say for certain. It is very cold, and the internet is working very badly, so I'm sorry for the technical problems.
Oh, it's okay. I don't know what that word means anyway, but Tegan has a question for you.
That is really cold. Zach, we were curious, how have the Iditarod mushers been reacting to the news of the positive COVID test out on the trail?
I asked one or two and they hadn't really heard very much about it. They're pretty focused on where they're at. And I don't know that that's the kind of news that's really kind of rippling and making it through. Also, with less volunteers on the trail this year, there's a very scaled back kind of communications apparatus. And I feel like that sort of news that ripples outward from checkpoints is rippling even more slowly and inconsistently than normal. So I'm not even sure how many mushers are aware that there was a positive test. So I'm not hearing a lot about it from them.
Fair. Maybe you can talk about the Iditarod checkpoint. What were you hearing about mushers, you know, as they get ready for their return down a trail to backtrack for the first time? What are they worried about? What are they talking about?
You know, they were thinking a lot about areas that are going to make head-on passing difficult. There's some kind of wooded areas where the trail's pretty narrow. I mean, it's a narrow trail to begin with. Even on a smooth, flat part, you have just enough room for two teams to cross each other. So some areas where there's hills or wooded thickets or sharp curves where you can't really see what's on the other side, they're worried about that because that could mean just running headlong into another team. So they're definitely thinking about that, but very few sounded worried. Aaron Peck had some sort of spots he'd cataloged in his mind of, you know, here's where you absolutely do not want to try and pass a dog team head on. But they didn't sound too phased about it. And, you know, Dallas Seavey pointed out that where he mushes along the trails in Willow, you know, on a weekend when there's lots of recreational mushers out, you'll do head-on passes with like 20 different teams just in the course of an afternoon with varying levels of familiarity with head-on passing. So some mushers get quite a bit of practice with it, even though it's not very normal in a race. And then I'm not sure that mushers are aware of this, but there's been quite a bit of snow in the sections between Rainy Pass and Nikolai that caused a lot of problems for mushers on the way down. A lot of glare ice, a lot of exposed gravel, a lot of tree stumps, driftwood, stuff like that, particularly on the Tatina River. And according to Mark Nordman, who I chatted with, his trail sweeps say, you know, there was a really good dusting of snow in the last couple of days. So it shouldn't be quite as hazardous, or at least not hazardous in the same way when mushers recross that area.
Zach, you wrote about this in the ADN the other day about how, you know, normally the race goes from Willow to Nome and there's no backtracking. And so if the musher encounters a problem, they kind of push through that problem and they just kind of continue on. But in this year's race, they're going back over the same trail. And so I suppose there are things that they've cataloged that they're thinking about to be prepared for. But is there also like a little bit more trepidation or a little bit more anxiety about some of those troubling sections of trail now that they have seen them already?
Anxiety was one word that explicitly came up. I believe Paige Drobny used that word when I caught up with her in Ophir a couple days ago. Was it a couple days ago, 2 days ago? I don't know. The days are, time is beginning to warp. Yeah, I mean, in a normal year, mushers get to say, you know, go through the gorge or through the burn, and it's harrowing, and they can say, oof, don't have to do that ever again or until next year. And, you know, several of them sort of laughed grimly and said, like, well, this year we know it's in store for us. I would say normally when you're running an Iditarod, it's sort of a fear of the unknown. Like, what's the weather on the coast going to be like? What are conditions on the Yukon going to be like? And yeah, this is the first time that a lot of these mushers are like, well, I sort of know what it's going to be like, and it's not good. But like I said, I mean, there's that snow that came in that should make it a pretty different experience one way or the other when they go back through. But yeah, that's definitely something that mushers were talking about. But hey, I mean, a lot of them were pretty nonchalant about it. You know, they know what they signed up for. Brent Sass in particular, I spoke with him for the first time, this Iditarod, and in Iditarod yesterday, he's a hard man to track down and catch. And he was very, very, very nonchalant about it characteristically, and kind of like, well, it is what it is.
You mentioned that Brent is a little elusive, and we actually have a clip from Iditarod Insider where he talks about how he hasn't really been staying in checkpoints. At that point, he hadn't actually taken a break in a checkpoint. He's, of course, by now taken his 24. But here's Brent Sass a little bit outside of Takotna.
Mainly because the dogs rest so much better out here, and I rest a little bit more. And we're just, I mean, the checkpoints are kind of a crazy place, and dog teams coming and going all the time. And, you know, there's a lot more distraction. And I like being in the woods. I don't spend a lot of time around people. So
Zach, I'm curious, you've been out around a bunch of sled dogs. I'm imagining there's a lot of good dogs out there. Is there any dog in particular that you have seen that you want to share with us? Maybe a dog name or a story about any of the dogs?
So many. Oh God, where to even begin? These dogs. Well, two little things. One, I've been around Dallas a lot. Just, you know, it's just how it works out. Some years you're like in a place and you see the same musher over and over again, and you see other mushers not at all. So been around Dallas quite a bit, and some of the dogs on his team, I believe the ones borrowed from Mitch, are pretty wolfish eaters, and Dallas has to sort of warn people away when he's doling out food, like, you know, kind of stay back from these guys. They get a little protective and feisty, like vets, reporters, everyone. He's like, hey guys, I'm about to start feeding, please stand very far back. So that's kind of funny. And then the other one, Wade Mars, has this particularly shaggy dog. It's nothing super remarkable. It's just kind of a long-haired sled dog. It looks a little bit like a lion or like an Ewok or something. And I asked Wade, because I was taking photos of it, and I was like, hey, Wade, what's this one's name? It doesn't look like the others. And Wade was like, oh, that's Kaiser. I got him from the Kaisers. And I was like, so he's named after Pete Kaiser? And he's like, no, he's just named Kaiser. I wanted to name him Ron, but Sophie, his partner, wouldn't let me. So we call him Kaiser. And I thought that was really, I don't know why, I just thought that was really funny. It's like a sled dog named for Ron Kaiser on Wade Mars's team.
He probably likes that. Ron does. We also have a clip, again, courtesy of Iditarod Insider, of Jesse Royer earlier in the race in McGrath talking about a dog of hers named Yor, but it's not the Yor that you think it is.
Hi, Yor. Yeah. Good boy.
So that dog's name is Yor?
Yeah, but it's not J-O-A-R, it's Y-O-U-R.
Oh.
So his mother's name was Brooks, and so I I named them all after rivers in the Brooks Range, but if you look at all the rivers in the Brooks Range, they're about this long and you can't pronounce most of them. And so Echuca is his sister on the team, and Yor was one of the names I could pronounce. So that wasn't a mile long. So yeah, I have a Yor, but it's not spelled the same as the musher.
It's a different Yor Olsen.
Turns out that's a very common name, it turns out.
People correct her all the time and call it the UR River.
Zach, in your ADN articles, you described the checkpoints and how different and scaled down they looked like this year. Can you like set the scene at one of the checkpoints, whether it's Iditarod or somewhere else, and just where are mushers sleeping this year? You know, so usually we see them often eating in heated buildings. Where are they eating their meals? What does it look like during the 2021 Iditarod?
It's effectively all outdoors. I mean, the exception is McGrath, where they have an airplane hangar and a dog lot that's really cordoned off. Inside in the airplane hangar, there were mats for mushers to sleep on, but just a giant open room. I mean, nothing. it's one creature comfort was that there were walls. But, you know, by contrast, like Ophir, there was one Arctic oven for, you know, any mushers who stayed there to sleep. And there were 8 mushers taking their 24s at Ophir, and about 4 of them can fit into that Arctic oven. And that's where they've also got to dry out their clothes. That was a bigger challenge for them than the sleeping accommodations. So Paige Drobny and Cody Strath are a couple. They had a tent, I think they were sharing or like swapping out, you know, who was in it at different points. A lot of mushers just during the day don't really have a problem sleeping out in sleeping bags or on sleeping mats, just out next to their teams. But there's just not a lot of indoor space for them to use and occupy. They're eating by their sleds. There's not really cabins that are open and set up for even volunteers to be in. Who knows with the mushers? They're like a much hardier breed, but for the pilots, for the volunteers, for the reporters that are there, it makes a big difference to not be able to duck inside and warm up when it's, you know, 0 or 10 below with a little bit of breeze, whatever it was. It's just cold.
Yeah, well, we hope you stay warm and you make it back for the finish safely. And we should probably let you go, but thanks for the update, Zach, and for talking to us.
Thanks, Zach.
Thank you guys. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it'd be cool to be there. I never get to see the finishes. I think I've seen like 2 finishes in 6 or 7 years of covering the Iditarod. So it'd be cool. I don't know. But yeah, I miss you guys. And I hope you're doing well. I hope you're eating better than I am. I hope you're eating a lot of vegetables. I haven't had a vegetable in quite some time. And yeah, I hope you're not just eating like trail mix and ramen noodles and zone bars.
Mostly dog food with hot water.
And chicken fat and a little bit of kibble to break it up.
Yeah. All right, buddy. Well, thanks again. And we hope to see you soon.
Yeah, stay warm out there. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So maybe not so many concerns that we know about anyway from Gunnar Johnson's positive COVID-19 test. Maybe some concerns, some anxiety creeping in about the trail that mushers have seen already that they now have to go back over. There actually was a slight change to the trail since our last episode. The trail had been shortened this year to 850 miles, of course, heading from Willow out to Iditarod. And then there was a little loop that was going to go from Iditarod to another ghost town called Flat, old mining town out there. I know a lot of mushers were stoked to go see that because it was this new part of the trail, but it turns out that they actually had to cut that piece out, that 20-mile section, now shortening an already shorter Iditarod.
Right, and that shortened trail was because of too much snow. The Iditarod has this trail crew on snow machines that basically every year carves out a route for the Iditarod teams and marks it with wooden sticks so they know where they're going. And this year, we heard from the race director that there was I think his quote was eyebrow deep snow in that area around the Iditarod flat ghost towns. And so he said basically the folks on the snow machines, the trail crew, couldn't carve out a safe trail to do that 20-mile loop. So it got eliminated.
I mentioned this to somebody and I got it wrong. And I said that the snow was eyelash deep.
I kind of like that better.
Well, that she didn't get it because she was like, well, so not very much snow, just like as thin as an eyelash. Oh. I was like, no, up to their eyebrows is what it was, like head deep snow. Anyways, as for what that actually means, cutting out that 20-mile section of trail, these mushers and dogs, they're used to a full 1,000 miles already that, you know, normally would have gone from Willow to Nome. But in this shorter race, they're still required to take the same mandatory rest stops of 2 8-hour breaks and 1 24-hour break. And that means shifting their strategies around a little bit in terms of run rest schedules and where to take those layovers. That's something that mushers have talked about. The race, you know, may be a day or more shorter, but they are still taking 1 24, 1 8, another 8. So that's just a bigger proportion of the total race. And where you take those breaks, which you can, two of them, you can make decisions about where to take them on the trail. That's going to be a more crucial part of the planning. Speaking of CVs and strategy, as there's probably nobody better at mushing strategizing, we called up, not Dallas, who's out there somewhere on the trail leading the race as we're recording this, but we talked to his dad, Mitch Seavey, about strategy and what's to come.
Hello.
Hey, Mitch, this is Tegan and Casey Grove.
Hi. Good morning, guys.
Hey, Mitch. So you're taking this Iditarod off. How's that going? Is it weird to be a spectator this year?
It's highly unusual. I haven't sat out an Iditarod since 1994.
Oh, wow.
But I was prepared for it. I made up my mind even before last year's race that this year would be a year off, and I'm really enjoying it, honestly. So it's going very well. I enjoy being on the sidelines, and I've got actually 3 or 4 teams in the race that I'm really invested in, so I feel like I'm involved, but, you know, sitting by the stove this year.
How closely are you watching this year's race?
Extremely closely on the tracker and the information and the stats. Yes, I'm watching it almost every minute.
I guess that gets to kind of one of our first questions was, as you're tracking it, how would you describe how the race is shaping up so far? What you're thinking about in terms of maybe potential strategies we'll see from here on out? How many steps ahead are you looking and what are you seeing in terms of the front runners?
Yeah, of course, I'm pleased to report that my son Dallas Seavey is well in front right now. It seems like even after mandatory rests are adjusted for, he has about a 2-hour lead. And I expect he'll take his 8-hour mandatory rest in the grass and leave there looking very strong. So how it's shaping up is it looks to me like, and I'm proud and pleased to be able to say that it looks like Dallas is in the best position, and there's a few teams right behind him that are chasing, but some teams are now through Ophir coming south. I think Brent Sass and Wade Mars and some others, but it looks like Dallas is in a great position.
And how did he get there? I mean, a lot of these guys have talked about where they had planned to take their 24s or their floating 8-hour break. Is that a big factor, you think, in how Dallas and other folks have ended up at the front of the pack? And what else do you think kind of put them there?
Well, there are so many factors that go into that, of course. But when you're an observer watching the race, as I am this year, you see their position, you see the time, you see the running speed, you see whether they've taken their mandatories or not. So, yes, where you choose to take that time does matter. And it, of course, is taken where it's the most beneficial to the dogs. But keep in mind, this race is roughly 100 miles shorter than usual. And yet there's the same amount of mandatory rest in the race. And so the mandatory rest is even a bigger factor this year because these guys are all used to running a regular 1,000-mile race. And this year it's 100 miles shorter. And so this mandatory rest is a bigger factor. They have to ration their stop time between mandatories even more closely. So I think time management is one thing that's gotten Dallas ahead. And honestly, I think he's got a really amazing dog team.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the dogs specifically. And as you're, you know, watching the stats and looking at numbers and things like that, I imagine maybe you're also trying to keep an eye on the dogs as much as you can, maybe on the insider videos. And so I wonder, is that true? Are you even able to kind of like get a good look at the dogs? And what are you seeing in Dallas's team or maybe other teams in terms of just what the dogs look like?
Well, the dogs look amazing. And yeah, the insider videos are awesome. And I think people should get on there and see what they can see. I just watched a video that stated they weren't able to upload all their content from Iditarod. So it has been a while since I've seen Dallas's team or a video of it. But when he left McGrath northbound, they looked incredible. And I believe that they're performing just as well now. He's rested and taken care of them back to McGrath. I can see that the dogs are eager. I can see that they're eating. I can see that they're all pulling. I can see that as he left McGrath, he had trouble with speed control getting out of there. You know, he left in a cloud of dust. And so I think his team looks amazing as I've seen on the videos.
Dallas has the lead now. They've still got hundreds of miles to go. What will you be watching most closely over the next couple of days here, final days of the race? In terms of, you know, particularly challenging parts of the trail you think there might be, or, you know, rest strategies, run strategies moving forward?
Sure. Moving forward from McGrath, you know, southbound back to the Deschke Landing finish, the obvious difficult part is going back to the mountain range. And we're familiar with terms like the Happy River Steps or the Dalzell Gorge. And I think what people miss sometimes is those big downhill drops that can be so terrifying and so difficult have equal and opposite uphills on a normal year when we're going north. Well, now the teams are going back down those equal and opposite hills, if you will. And so there's some places out there that don't even have names that are going to be the scary parts this year because the teams have never gone back through that way. So I think most teams, and I would have to say probably every musher out there, is thinking, oh my goodness, I have to go back through that. And I think that's going to be a big factor. I think confidence, I think sled driving capabilities. And don't forget that it's a mountain range and energy and power in the dog teams going up those big hills that they usually go down is going to be a big factor. So a rested dog team, a strong dog team, big dog team is going to be a real asset going back through there.
That makes sense. And Mitch, I have to ask, who do you think will be the first to cross the finish line this year and around what time?
Well, I have to go with Dallas as to be the first one to cross the finish line because right now he appears to have a pretty solid lead. It's not certainly not insurmountable. And if he has some problems, anything can happen. And that's one of the things that's exciting. This year's going to throw some curveballs undoubtedly to some teams going back through the mountains. I think that this race is probably going to end in less than 7.5 days. So that puts it late at night on the 14th, early morning 15th, probably. And possibly even quicker than that. But I hate to put unrealistic expectations out there in the atmosphere.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, trying to figure out when to be there. Are you going to be there at the finish?
I will be. Lord willing, and the creek don't rise, I'm going to be there. And we'll see what happens. But probably be middle of the night on the 14th, 7 days and some hours, I imagine. If all goes well. Now, of course, anything can happen. Anything can happen. I understand that in the Dalzell Gorge, which they have to go back up the gorge, I understand a lot of the ice bridges broke down and caved in as the last of the teams came through. The Iditarod Trail Committee, of all the things that they do well for this race, the trail breakers are the most amazing. And so those guys are in that gorge now again, building that up, changing the angle of the bridges for uphill approaches rather than downhill. And they're putting that trail back in the gorge. So I expect it to be probably tricky and technical, but safe and passable as the teams come back through.
Well, Mitch, thanks so much for being on. We appreciate it. Also have to ask, will we see you racing in the 2022 Iditarod?
My position on future Iditarods is very neutral. And that's sort of my goal, is to give myself mental time think about that sort of thing and give my body some time to heal up from decades of mushing abuse. And I really don't have a response to that other than it's a definite maybe.
Fair enough.
Well, Mitch, thanks so much for talking to us.
Okay, thanks for including me. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye now.
Well, that was great. Three-time Iditarod champion Mitch Seavey on the phone. Definitely knows what he's talking about when it comes to the Iditarod. He's been around this race his whole life. And yeah, we're just getting all kinds of questions answered today, aren't we?
We really are.
So now it's time for today's listener question.
Hi, my name is Jordan and I live in Anchorage, and my dog Niles and I are always struggling with booties. How do you keep booties on the dogs? Do you have any tips for keeping them from filling up with snow? And how many pairs do you bring with you for each dog for a race like the Iditarod?
Hi, mushing fans and enthusiasts. This is Linwood Fiedler, 25-time Iditarod finisher. Hey, we've got a question about dog booties. One is keeping them on their feet and how many we use along the Iditarod race trail. We use about 2,000 booties along the race. When you look at a dog that's trotting down the trail at 9-10 miles an hour, each foot is touching the ground about 3 times a second. So you can imagine every second there's 12 paws that touch the ground. And so we use a lot of booties to protect their feet. If you're putting booties on your pet at home for a walk and they're coming off, people tend to have a tendency to put them on too loosely. So I would just try tightening it up a little bit. Sometimes when rookies put on booties, they're hesitant to hurt the dog and they put them on too loose and they go for a walk and they start flinging off everywhere. So they need to go on a little tighter. The one thing is that when you stop, you should not keep a tight booty on their foot. You'll want to take it off fairly quickly so you don't cut off circulation. But while the dog's moving or going for a walk, running, ski joring, that booty can be on fairly tight so it stays on securely on their foot. Hope this helps. See you down the trail.
All right, Jordan, thanks for the great question. And Linwood, also a great answer. We really appreciate that. And we certainly appreciate getting your questions. We are somewhat closing in on the end of the race here, but we would really still love to get more questions about dog mushing or the Iditarod if you have them. The best way to do that is to send us a voice memo. Most smartphones have an app already built in, and you can record yourself asking whatever your question is and then send that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. And the ever-hustling Tegan Hanlon will try to find an Iditarod musher to answer that for you, or we'll give it a shot ourselves. And, of course, you can find a whole lot more content, including written-out stories, photos, past episodes of the Iditapod. That's at alaskapublic.org/Iditarod. Again, this is a production of Alaska Public Media. Our theme music, as always, is by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove.
And I'm Tegan Hanlon.
And until next time, happy trails. Cold open, I guess, might be just some sled dog noises.
It sounds
like
nice.
The easiest thing. welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else? Cruising with your sled dogs. Sled dogs. Oh, and the Iditarod. Your production of Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Casey Grove, joined once again by my colleague, reporter Tegan Hanlon.
Hello, Casey.
Before we slide on out of here.
Yeah. Cruise on in, slide on out, bark on out.
Before we
freeze.
We're cruising with our sled dogs.
Breeze by.
Well, a good one is before we pull the hook.
Oh, nice.
Pull the hook and... Before we pull the hook and mush on out. And I still need to talk to Lee, but we'll just do that. And then I will dial Mitch Seavey.
Three-time champion.
Okay. I'm not going to rub it in that Dallas is a four-time champion.
Almost, potentially five.
No comment. Oh, wait, I'm blowing it. I'm blowing it already. Okay, everyone, quiet on the set. Here we go. I'm going to just start rolling on this and calling.
Okay.
And then he'll be on the phone and he can't say no. He's got time.
You've reached Zach Hughes?
No!
Please leave a message and I'll get right back.
Zach, hey, it's Casey. I just got a call from a lawyer for the band Sassafras. I don't know what to tell you. There's a process server on his way to McGrath right now. He's flying a plane. He will be there soon. So, I don't know, man. Good luck. See you in court.